I was really privileged to see a performance of some storytelling in two environments, actually, the first of which was at Timber Festival, and the second of which was at People Express. And the project was called If the Trees Could Talk, and it's a great project. It's basically kind of, you know, a curated storytelling experience around fairy tales. And these fairy tales have been created by the LGBT plus communities in and around Derby and Derbyshire. And Tom, who kind of performs the stories, and you'll hear Alex as well, who performs, just did a great job in kind of telling these fairy tales, you know, and they really kind of got you to think, and they're a lot of fun, you know, and there was kind of audience interaction, which you'll hear, and things like that. So this podcast really is the recording of that at People Express, and you'll hear all of the stories in full. It's about an hour, and I just hope you enjoy it. If you look at the podcast description, you'll see all the links to all the different organisations that were involved, and you'll be able to check out their work further. So, yeah, over to Tom.
If the trees could talk, what would they say? What words would they speak if we listened today? What stories they'd have, yearning to be told, the legends weaved into their branches they hold, the spirits of nature, secrets of the past, the breath of the future, outlasting the ashes of those long forgotten, the sparks of those yet to be. These are the stories to be told by the trees. So I will be your storyteller for the day. Yes, I'm called Tom, but you can call me whatever you like. I've been called much worse. Allow me to tell you such rich stories inspired by the lives of those who sought to reconnect with the woods. A wild space which can be as overwhelming as it can be safe, as welcoming as it is threatening, as dark as it is beautiful. Let us begin. So, this is the story of Willow the Hedgehog. Now, you might have seen her wandering around the woods. She has a bow in her hair and always wears an apron because she loves baking. She didn't always live in the woods, though. In fact, she lived in a den under a busy road, which Willow had turned into a beautiful home. It looks a little like an old man's house, with a polished wooden grandfather clock happily tick-tocking in the background, a real fireplace burning birchwood logs and tall, tall pillars. A whole house underground, warm and cosy, with bedrooms, bathrooms and office. Unless you'd seen it, you wouldn't believe your eyes. Now, Willow had three hedgehog babies. Max, the eldest, was the biggest and the strongest, annoying to his siblings, but somehow always charming to others. Maya, the middle hedgehog, wore her spikes long, was the most helpful and the smartest. And finally, there was little Garibaldi, the shortest and stubbiest, the greediest and silliest, and unfortunately, not as sharp as the spines on his back. But Willow loved each of her babies very, very much. But one sad day, while they were out for a bite to eat, Willow and the babies lost their home. Oh. The den they had lived in was filled in with concrete by people who wanted to lay down more roads. Her three babies cried, "Whatever will we do?" Not wanting to panic, though, Willow soothed her babies. "We'll find somewhere new to live, you'll see." But there was plenty of food, and she could have a nice cup of tea. Now, not so lucky for them, a curious, sneaky fox called Red was eavesdropping on the conversation. He told Willow he knew of a place she could live. On the other side of the busy road, across the river, there were woodlands where Willow and her babies could live up a tree. "Much safer than underground," said he. He seemed kind enough, so Willow thanked him and followed his advice. The trouble was, Red was only pretending to be nice. Red Fox had other plans to take Willow's babies away and bake them into a pie. Red Fox was going to try everything he could to trick Willow and her family. "First," explained Red to Willow, while trying not to lick his lips, "you have to cross the road. I know there are cars, but fear not. It's safe to cross at night. It's easier when it's dark." Sweet and naive, Willow and her three babies didn't realise crossing at night is more dangerous. But again, they thanked Red Fox and set off on their way. Willow took the lead, bundling herself up into a ball until she was very small and rolling across the road. Being the strongest, Max went next, and Maya, the smartest, followed. Red was not impressed by their success, as he thought he was going to have hedgehog pizza for dinner. Until the fox realised poor little Garibaldi had been left behind, and Red thought he had his chance. Garibaldi would make a fine pie. As Garibaldi clumsily rolled into the road, a car drove straight over him. But, again, Red Fox didn't get his wish. The wheels narrowly missed Garibaldi, who tumbled out in one piece on the other side. Drat! Cursed Red Fox. He needed to come up with another plan as he led the hedgehog family from the road to the next part of their journey. Now, they arrived at a bridge to cross the river, just like Red Fox had said. Thinking on his paws, an idea hit Red. Out of branches and leaves, he quickly fashioned a disguise, draping it all over him like a cape and a hood. Sneaking up from behind them, he leapt out at Willow and cried, "Your babies are going to be hobnapped!" It gave the hedgehogs such a fright, they fell over the bridge's side. Red Fox couldn't wait, picturing himself slipping down to the water to fish out the hedgehogs with his mouth and claws, ready to be cooked. He listened for the sound of the splashes, but never heard them hit the river, because four long arms came out from under the arch and caught the hedgehogs, one after the other, because under this bridge lived a troll. A special one, too, with bright blue skin, red tentacles, floppy ears, and a glowing unicorn horn. He said he would help the hedgehogs if they could answer a riddle. "I eat and I grow. I drink and I die. What am I?" Garibaldi was worried because he couldn't think of the answer. Can anyone help him? Not you. Can anyone help him with the answer to the riddle? Never fear, because Willow knew that the answer was fire. The troll was so happy, his unicorn horn glowed green. And with that, he kept his promise and gently tossed them across the river and at last into the woods. Which would have been great if the troll wasn't such a careless shot, because he threw Willow too high, and from her baby she got lost. Oh. Well, as you can imagine, Red Fox was pleased and began to sneak towards the three babies, his tummy rumbling all the while. But luckily, Willow swooped down from the sky, landed on Red and knocked him on the head, shouting, "Don't you hognap my babies, you hognapper!" Red Fox stumbled back, fell into the river, where he was carried away by the current to the troll. Plucking a rather wet Red Fox out of the water, the troll asked Red the same riddle. "I eat and I grow. I drink and I die. What am I?" I don't know the answer," Red Fox stammered. "Trolls eat foxes that can't solve riddles." And Red Fox was baked into a pie. Now safe and sound, the hedgehogs built their new home in a tree, and Willow had her biscuit with a nice cup of tea. And a round of applause, please, for Alex, who was the co-author of that rather wonderful story. Fabulously vivid imagination to rival my own, and I'm dressed as a tree. So, another story from the SWAT squad, I do believe we were dubbed by the end of the workshops. This is the story of Snakeena, who inspired this fabulous jacket. Have you ever heard of the other worlds? They are realms just bordering our own, where guardians and demons live in secret, observing and watching over humans just like you. One such dweller of these realms was a demon girl, Snakeena, who lived in a cave on the outskirts of the forest. Now, for as long as she could remember, Snakeena was told that being evil was good. Her parents, who went only by their demon names, Killer and Fire, taught Snakeena that doing wrong was right. They lived by the code of a gruesome place known as the Blood World, Wicked people were sent there to be punished, but Killer and Fire claimed that all humans must be punished, no matter how they behaved. Now, soon after Snakeina had her sixth birthday, she was walking through the woods and saw something moving in the trees. Snakeina was curious and slinked quietly through the long green grass to get closer. A stunning, strong woman stood before her, with hair red as strawberries on one side and black as night on the other, a mystical symbol drawn delicately to trace the side of her face. Snakeina was so distracted by the stranger's beauty, she didn't realise something else was creeping up behind her. Something with large golden wings, but bigger than any bird that she'd ever seen. And before she could react, Snakeina was caught and pulled up from the grass. She started to scream, but when she saw her attacker's face, she gasped. It was a guardian angel. She'd never seen one in person. "Don't be afraid," Snakeina was told. "We're not going to hurt you. But why are you spying on us?" Snakeina blushed, lost for words. The woman with red and black hair introduced herself as Queen Stella, a ruler of the other worlds. Stella wasn't like any demon Snakeina had ever encountered before. She dressed more like the humans that Snakeina had been warned about, the ones her parents told her were weak. Gesturing to the angel stood beside them, Stella said, "And this is my guardian, Sonia." Snakeina cautiously shook hands on Sonia's wing. Snakeina didn't understand why the two of them were together. "I thought demons and guardians couldn't be friends, let alone protect humans." And Queen Stella laughed and spoke of being kind, loyal, honest, all the things Snakeina's parents taught her were bad. Together, she and Stella looked after those in the other worlds. They were protectors of humans and not their enemies. Sonia and Stella told Snakeina the truth about Bloodworld, that it was a terrible place full of horror. Snakeina was confused by this and started to wonder, had everything she'd learned growing up been a lie? It was beginning to get dark, and so Snakeina rushed home, afraid what would happen if Killer and Fire came looking for her, and found her speaking with a guardian angel and a good demon. Sonia and Stella bid her farewell, saying she would always be welcome to see them again. After a restless night, inspired by what she'd heard, Snakeina plucked up the courage to tell her parents that she wanted to be good. She wanted to do good things. And Killer and Fire were furious and banished Snakeina from the cave, saying if they ever saw her again, they might not be so merciful in future. And with that, Snakeina was sent to the woods to fend for herself. Lost, scared, Snakeina realised her parents were cruel, and being evil wasn't good. It was fortunate that Queen Stella and Sonia heard Snakeina's cries, comforted her, and took her to stay with them. It was living with Stella and Sonia that Snakeina learned more about humans and the blood world and how to do good for others. Many years passed of them living happily together. But it's not the end of the story. Ooh. As a guardian, Sonia possessed a magic mirror which allowed her to observe those in the other worlds. One day, she was shocked to receive a warning through its glass. Snakeina's demon parents had grown more powerful with time and were plotting to take over the other world and turn it into another blood world where all would suffer under its rule. When Sonia told Queen Stella and Snakeina, she reassured both, as worried as they might be, that she had a plan. She would use her guardian powers, and together they'd all go into the woods to stop Killer and Fire from carrying out their terrible deeds. Now all grown up, Snakeina knew she had to be brave and face her wicked parents. She and her friends travelled deep into the woods, back to the cave where Snakeina had been banished from as a young girl. Quietly, they crept through the cave, through the darkness, seeking out Snakeina's parents. Killer and Fire were infuriated at Snakeina's boldness when they found them entering their lair with a guardian no less after she'd been banished all those years ago. But before Killer and Fire could react and attack Sonia, Snakeina used her wings to fly up, and by showing Killer and Fire their reflections in the mirror, she turned both of them into gold and silver statues. to serve as a reminder to anyone else that being bad gets you quite literally nowhere. It's better to be good and kind. That night, Stella and Sonia threw a big party to celebrate that the other world was safe once again, but also for Snakina for being so brave. And she realised she'd found the family she'd always wanted to have. So, next, I would like to invite a young storyteller and poet and writer in the making. I mean, not really in the making, you're already there, aren't you? To tell his own story, because, and I quote, I wouldn't get it right if I did it. So, please welcome up Alex, another Alex. And there is also a call and response to this section, so I will lead the way and I will invite all of you to join in with gusto. So to introduce this piece of Toughnut and Tilly, the fairy have been here since the dawn of time, a race that flourished like no other on earth, living in the trees. But when the men came, the fairy kingdom was lost. Those who fought survived, but those who didn't are long gone. The men vandalized the earth, building their houses and roads, concrete blocks reaching high into the sky. But the men were foolish, and soon the world went up in flames. The fairy kingdom rose again from the broken earth. They built their kingdom in the burnt trees and flourished once more. But there was a problem.
It was 2063 when the queen rose up from the dust, with her long black hair tucked up tight against her scalp and a glare so sharp she could pierce glass. It was 2063 when she decreed that love between grass and oak fairy was a crime. That filth was not to be seen in her city. It was 2063 when the fairy queen said, your so-called love will be punishable by death, and she smiled. Toughnut was built of oak, constructed out of broken things, sharp-cheeked bones as if carved from the side of a cliff, faced by eyes so soft the deep grey. You could get lost in them. Oak fairy were always seen as the toughest, the ones with sharp edges, never afraid and always determined. People said they were built from the ancient trees. They had light brown wings protruding from their shoulder blades and short black hair nearly obscuring their face. They were always thought of as the toughest fairy race, but maybe that wasn't quite true. Tilly had long ginger hair and bright blue eyes that shone like the stars. In the darkest of nights, she was caring, considerate. The other fairies called the grass fairies delicate, said they were too sensitive, laughed at the way that they floated on the wind without wings, just let the breeze carry them. But the grass fairies had a hidden bravery, a courage within that let them live. There's more strength than most know in kindness. There's more strength than most know in kindness. The sunlight stumbled upon the fairy kingdom, the streets and the trees bright with April light. Tilly was in her garden planting sunflowers. She plucked one and tucked it behind her ear, almost lost in her unruly ginger locks. The wind swept her off her feet, and she let herself be tossed into the air by the breeze, but she lost her sunflower as it tumbled and it fluttered from its place behind her ear. Slowly but surely, dancing and twirling right down to the ground, but it was found by an old fairy flying past. And the fairy let it fall right into her hand. She took it up to Tilly and she said, this is pretty, as she giggled and she handed it back. It was unusual to see an oak fairy look happy, but this one had a smile painted right across a face that portrayed a rebellious sort of grace. And the fairy said, follow me this way, and it's Toughnut, by the way, and Tilly knew that she probably shouldn't, but intrigued, she took the hand of Toughnut, who instantly jumped off the edge, wings spread, she led them up into the air, up into the sky so high, and Tilly couldn't help but smile. It was so beautiful, looking down from the clouds, she could see everything, the market, the houses, the palace, the whole kingdom, perched atop its branches. And Toughnut continued, going up, 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 until she landed on the highest peak of the highest tree, and the two of them lay down on the canopy and they spoke. They spoke of the things they had seen, of the things they had dreamed, of what they were and what they wanted to be. They spoke for hours, and they returned every day to their corner of the sky, and they watched the clouds dance as they spoke heart to heart, whispering secrets in the dark. It was months, but eventually they allowed themselves to fall in love. They knew the law, and they knew it was forbidden, but their souls met, and they wouldn't part. They spent as much as they could of their time together. They wished for a world that was better, until in a few years they had enough of hiding their love, and they decided, despite their fears, to disappear, to escape, to find another place, to see a fair world outside of the city walls. But as they made their way to the kingdom's gate, They were met by a man who wouldn't let them run astray, and their hands were cuffed. Tilly and Toughnut had been caught. They were standing in a cell in the court. Four walls were encased by stone and locked in a gate built of iron. As the gate rose, the view showed a stone platform, and on its back a diamond throne. Off the edges you could see fire in the darkness. It burnt deep red, looking murderous. The queen looked on from a chair, and Toughnut couldn't help but think she looked dead. She was pale, but dark beneath the eyes. Her wings looked like they were forced out of her bones, pushed out of her shoulder blades. Her eyes shone redder than the flames in the pit that lay below. The queen might sit on a diamond throne, but her heart was carved from the ashes left by men. She said, "I don't let many see me, for I look a monster, a feeble creature. Believe me, I'm not. But I like the way that your kind look when you beg me for mercy, so I come to watch. You have been convicted of the crimes of oak grass romance in a public place and of oak grass romantic delusion. It is time for you to be tried. If you don't desire to die, I suggest you both give up hope now. If you don't want to go out screaming your lungs out, I suggest you both give up hope now." Tilly stood up, brave as ever, ready to talk. But it was a surprise when Tilly rose up and gently pushed aside Toughnut, and she said, "I love her. Don't let that be lost. How can love possibly disgust? Maybe we don't fit your standards. Maybe grass fairy and oak fairy were never meant to fit together, but I promise we both fit better than most in this town of ever. I could get on my knees, beg you to let us breathe, but I'm not sure that we could ever please you. I'm not sure that we could ever please you. But if this is the day that my wings and my heart stop beating, let it be known that I love the way she scrunches up her nose. Let it be seen that I love the way freckles fleck her face like a constellation painted on her cheeks. Let it be heard that I love the way her hair spills over her face like the waves of an ocean in a world that thinks we are broken. For the way we feel, let it be shouted that our love is real. We've kept this a secret for years and years. And as I stand here with my hand in hers, facing the very worst, I feel no fear, because I know that our voices have been heard. And if I lose all else today, at least I know that I am going out with her." This is the call and response, so I'll say a line and then you say it. "The queen cackled.
The queen cackled.
She stepped forward.
She stepped forward.
With a grin on her face.
With a grin on her face.
From one side to another.
From one side to another.
She pulled out a blade.
She pulled out the
blade. Still dripping in blood.
Still dripping in blood.
From an earlier deed.
From an earlier deed.
And she stood.
And she stood.
She stepped forward.
She stepped forward.
Towards Tilly.
Towards Tilly.
And the queen punched her knife.
And the queen punched her knife.
Right into Tilly's stomach.
Right into Tilly's stomach.
Tilly was scared as she fell to the ground. Blood on her sleeve, seeping into the stone. Toughnut screamed as she ran to her love, took Tilly in her arms and shielded her from the darkness that pushed at the side of her eyes. And Tilly whimpered, "My love, am I going to die?" She lay fragile in the arms of the one closest to her heart. Her breathing became shallow. Her body became limp. And Tilly said her final words, "Toughnut, I love you."
While Toughnut was left alone on the courtroom floor, trembling with her dead girlfriend in her arms, the Queen made one big mistake. Word spread of Tilly and Toughnut's tragic story, and the fairy citizens became aware of the pain and hatred being spread by the Queen. One by one, they rose up in rebellion until it was unavoidable, impossible to ignore. It took time and effort, but eventually the Fairy Queen fell, and the fairy kingdom in the trees flourished in joy and happiness once more. Fabulous!
Absolutely.
Who's ready for something a bit more surreal next? So, next we have the story of Hippie and the Woodcutters. Once there was a hippie, you need to know nothing more, for not much was known about him. Not to begin with, anyway. He liked to keep himself to himself. He enjoyed walking in nature and being at peace. But instead, he spent too much of his time stressed with lessons and exams, and a black-hearted headmistress intent on ruining his life. So as you can imagine, Pippi was pretty thrilled when one day, shortly after he'd escaped his last class at school and was walking through some woods, a badger leapt out from the shrubs. He greeted him with a whistle, and the badger cocked his head. Pippi put down his bag to give the badger a pet. Then out of nowhere, the badger grabbed the rucksack and left. And worse still, Hippy's bag contained the notes for an upcoming test. Hippy was stunned and confused, not sure why a woodland creature would be so taken with his dull school books. But nevertheless, he needed them. He could hear the mean headmistress's voice in his head, "Trust you to fail again." Hippy sprang into action, chasing after the badger to retrieve the books. It was only after zipping and nipping through the woods, chasing this badger at full speed, badgers are faster than you realise, you see, that Hippy came to a scary-looking notice he didn't expect to find, nailed to a tree. It said the woods were in danger. The trees were being cut down, carted away to be turned into paper. That's when you can boo at this point.
Boo!
Hippy whistled sadly to the badger, who seemed to understand. Their mutual languages, badgers squeaked and grunted back, an unhappy sound Hippy recognised easily. He didn't have to be asked twice. He needed to help the badger, didn't he?
Yes!
They needed to protect the trees, didn't they?
Yes!
The woodcutters soon started to show. One at first, and as a tree was struck with a blow, another one appeared. Then with each chop, 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 another arrived, as if somehow they'd magically multiplied. Soon there seemed to be hundreds, all bashing and slashing their axes against the trees. "Why are you doing this?" Hippy cried. "You know our boss," the woodcutters replied, and showed them the contract. Hippy gasped when he clocked by who it was signed, the villainous headmistress at his school. Who would have known a head teacher could be so unprincipled? She was the very one who'd endeavoured to spoil all his fun. She'd ordered the paper from the trees to print out more impossible tests. Hippy could no longer stand idle and sidled up to a woodcutter to grab at the axe. Clutching its hilt, the woodcutter collapsed. It seems in the tool was where laid the magic, and then poof, the woodcutter disappeared. Then the axe grew arms and legs, and off it veered. Hippy knew what he had to do, running to other woodcutters to stop them in their tracks, one by one bravely sending off their axes by pulling them out of the woodcutter's hands, trying to put an end to the headmistress's plans. But there were too many of them, hundreds, it wasn't enough. Hippy whistled and clicked, and Badger understood. His woodland family and friends needed to join them from under the earth. They all combined together, an army of mammals combining and climbing on top of one another to form one ginormous mega badger. Hippy cheered. The woodcutters would soon be beaten, licked up by this giant badger beast as if being eaten. With the woodcutters gone, they thought it was over, until a piercing shriek came from behind their shoulders. The headmistress had arrived, livid that her plans had been foiled. "I'll get you for this, Hippy," she screamed, "for the exams you've just spoiled." But before she could get to Hippy, the badgers intercepted, and the headmistress too was quickly digested. And shortly after she was eaten, well, she came out the other end, planted in the dirt to fertilise a new seed. But if you look closely, guess what you could see? In the bark of this tree, you could see her twisted face, trapped forever in this wooden place, to think forever about all the awful ways she treated others. Plus, the tree made a great urinal for dogs and their walkers. And so the forest was saved!
Yay!
They lived happily ever after. So remember, be kind to nature and don't mess with badgers. It's very hot in this forest. Okay, so another round of applause for the squad. Can't say it. Swad squad. There we go. And now what we're going to move on to is I've also travelled far and wide across all these many distant lands to Derbyshire, and met a group in Belper who told me some really wonderful stories about their histories, their personal histories growing up as gay men, kind of throughout the 50s and 60s and 70s, and all their different life experiences. So from hearing their stories, together we wrote this poem. So this is the story of James and Jack. Every day since they were three, James met Jack beneath their favourite tree. Hidden away from the eyes of others, James's bad-tempered father and Jack's busybody mother, they played their games and made their wishes, and when they grew up to be young men, shed stolen kisses. And as open hearts are so very capable of, James and Jack found themselves in love. But then one morning, James journeyed there. He couldn't see or find Jack anywhere. Every day since they were young, they'd met at rise and set of sun, and James realised, as his worry stung, that something must have been wrong. When seeking answers, he heard terrible news. Jack had been ambushed by a pack of wild wolves. James' chest filled with overwhelming dread, in fear his beloved might be dead. But when in his mother he tried to confide, she said, "You're better off without him at your side." When he questioned why, blinking back his tears, his mother cruelly spoke James's deepest fears, saying even Jack's own father deemed him a waste of time. He was one of those soft, unforgivable types. The wolves did you a favour. You won't see Jack again, and you always should have stayed away from him. But James's Aunt Ruby piped up from her tea, gently musing, "Jack was always so sweet and kind to me." But by his sister's eyes, Ruby was quickly scolded and banished her from the kitchen, there's clothes need folded. Crying through the night, James couldn't sleep. At the loss of Jack and in deepest grief, he clasped his hands, praying for strength, willing his broken heart to mend. Then in the dark, he heard wood creaking, and startled, leapt up, about to shriek, until a hushed voice shushed him from the pitch black, whispering, "It's Aunt Ruby, meet me out back." So quiet as he could, James crept to his feet, wrapping up from the cold in his thick bedsheets, and he crept outside into the night to find Ruby dim lit in the moon's silvery light. Ruby held her dear nephew in her arms, wishing she could free him of this harm. She lowered her voice, leaned in close and sighed, "My darling boy, I think Jack is still alive." James felt his stomach turning inside. He couldn't understand why anyone would lie. His Aunt Ruby said she couldn't explain. "It's only from eavesdropping I've done today. I've just got this feeling you shouldn't believe in what your mother told you." How could she deceive him? "Sweet boy," Ruby said, "I don't have the answers, but I do have these." And in her pocket she'd gathered several trinkets which she said James must take. "You have to find Jack. Leave before your mother wakes." Hurriedly, she pushed the items into his palm, saying, "Over the years, I've collected these charms, a whistle, a medallion, and a red, red rose. And this," she said, "is what will help you the most. A silver compass with hands and arrows red as fire. It leads you to whatever your heart truly desires. Though these items held power, there are only four. I believe something's missing. There should be one more." She didn't know what it looked like. She just had a clue. "It can't be owned by anyone, but it will belong to you." James took hold of his aunt and squeezed tight, thanked her for her kindness, then did a light into day's early stirring, away from his home, following directions the compass now showed. Soon the path started to lead him deeper and deeper, into the trees where the air grew thicker, his heart pounding and his mouth so dry, as the trees up above seemed to swallow up the sky. He followed the compass but came to a wall of grass so thick he could no longer see soil. He didn't trust the journey with no sight of the path, but while pondering this, he heard the break of a branch. Somewhere in the darkness, he swore he heard snapping of twigs underfoot and then sinister laughing. "Who's out there?" James bellowed, hoping his voice sounded threatening and strong and not like he was lost. Then out from the thicket leapt a spindly body, a weather-beaten creature rasped, "Who dares disturb Dolly?" James stumbled back, shocked, fell to the ground. The creature laughed again and then swooped down. This wizened old thing James now saw was a goblin. It crept over to him while James was still struggling. "You're a pretty young thing," the I said with a smile. And it seems you've been lost in my woods for a while. Please don't harm me. I'm looking for my friends, said James, frightened he may meet his end. Scrambling quickly, he reached into his pocket, reached in, found the medallion, and offered it as profit to the figure leaning over him. James didn't think twice, pleaded, I'll give you this coin if you spare me my life. The goblin's face dropped. He seemed visibly hurt. Defeated, he sat himself down in the dirt. Why is it each time someone lays eyes on me, they think I'm a monster? Dolly started to weep. The poor creature was sniffling, wiping his nose. James reached back into his bag and this time offered the rose. Dolly's eyes lit up like stars in the sky. All the goblin ever wanted was someone to be kind. You've made me so happy, I'm beside myself. How can I assist you? James was relieved for the help. I'm looking for someone taken by the wolves. With a shaking head, Dolly looked at James like a fool. You lovely young thing, you've no business with them. But James insisted he needed to seek out his friend. Dolly brought the rose to his crooked old mouth, sniffed the petals, then pointed a bony finger south. Avoid the wildflowers and follow the sun. You'll find what you seek. James thanked Dolly and spun on his heel to continue his search. Knowing if he had to, he'd look all over the earth. As he walked along, the sun started hiding, the lesser rays reaching through the branches dividing, but thinking on his feet, dangled the medallion from its rope. He held it to the remaining light, and just as he hoped, it cast enough shine to be used as a torch. And onwards through forest, he searched and he searched, and he searched and he searched until night had fallen and his eyelids were heavy and his feet felt all swollen. And poor James, so exhausted while he was walking, didn't notice the roots of a tree had crisscrossed him, and tripping on them, he lost his grip, and out of his fingers, the medallion did slip. And as the disc disappeared, reflecting beams from the moon, that's when he heard it, the stirring, the low growling of wolves. James leapt up fast, and dreading an attack, his mouth dry once more, chest so tight it might crack, he pictures his companion, the sweet face of Jack, and somewhat from the fear, he drew himself back, reached into his pocket and found his last charm, the whistle. He could blow it to raise the alarm, but it seemed when he blew, barely made a sound, though somehow it made angry wolves calm down. The leader of this pack trotted up to James's boots, looked up with a bent ear as if saying, who are you? I'm looking for my friend. Can you take me to him? The pack set off ahead and James followed them. He followed the line to a ginormous tree and in single file they each disappeared underneath through a tunnel in the ground, the entrance to their den. Down on hands and knees, James went after them, and there in a burrow curled up with some pups, James couldn't believe his eyes or his luck. Snuggled up with the pups like one of their own was Jack, his beloved, looking right at home. They rushed to each other, embraced and kissed. James couldn't explain how much he'd missed James since he'd been forced to get out of town. What do you mean? James's smile fell to a frown. Jack recounted the night when the mob had appeared. Assembled by Jack's father, he sobbed through his tears. Ignorant villagers with pickets and torches, spouting fire and brimstone, an eternity of torture. Jack said, they made a deal. If I left, you could stay. Explained it was all a matter who had more to pay. How did you find me? Or know where to go? They blamed it on wolves, James said. But now I know that was all a lie. I think the wolves kept you safe. And the wolves perked up at the gratitude from James. And I was given these treasures, these things by my aunt. She said that there were five of these special charms. Then James remembered out of four he'd lost three, and now all that remained was the compass in between them. James showed Jack the charm that brought him from the start, then noticed it pointed straight at James's heart. In that moment it dawned he'd solved his aunt's clue. It can't be owned by anyone, but it will belong to you. Because you don't always need to carry things along. Bits and pieces aren't what make us happy or strong. Either you don't need them or they're carried with you, like a gem of a memory, or love so very true. James didn't need those trinkets, the ones he now lacked. All that he needed was the love shared with Jack. Oh. There's no elegant way to wipe away a sweat tear, is there?
Okay.
So, some more stories, yes?
Yeah.
Excellent, marvellous. I mean, we're going to have to keep this energy going again. You have to pretend that you're like a massive stadium full of people. So, ready for more stories?
Yeah!
Excellent, thank you so much. So, this story came from the Chesterfield group that I worked with. And this is the tale of the Outsiders. So, the Outsiders hadn't always been that way. They used to be known by another name, a name long since forgotten, a name from when they lived in peace with others in a place called the Sacred Fields. Upon these lush green plains, they built their houses, their meeting places, everything they wished for, until one day they were driven out, forced into the trees by commands of the establishment known only as the Ivory. Looking to expand beyond their means, taking from the vulnerable outsiders was their solution. They came into the outsiders' lands with torches and blades, setting off explosions, wounding the innocent, some even fatally, but the outsiders wouldn't give up. They fought back, outsmarting the Ivory, fashioning weapons out of whatever they could, throwing rocks like boulders and pointed sticks like missiles. The outsiders outnumbered the Ivory, who had no choice but to retreat. But then came the plague, which cursed the outsiders' rebellion, a disease which tore through their community like wildfire. The outsiders were either too weak to retaliate or had succumbed to the illness. With a final push from the establishment of the Ivory, the surviving outsiders went quietly, though not willingly, from the fields into the forest. The outsiders struggled to recover, and many of their elders now gone, the next generation of their tribe had to carve their own path, teach themselves lessons that previously would have been handed down, their traditions, their rituals, their culture. Many years passed, more generations too, and with time, old wounds started to heal. Bridges were rebuilt to a degree. The outsiders tried to learn how to trust the Ivory again, relying on them at times to trade, but still they wouldn't forget the dark, intense history existing between them. And just as the outsiders felt they were becoming more accepted, the Ivory tried to impose further new laws. All those who now lived in the forest must sign the Book of the Known and declare themselves forever an outsider, relenting their rights to ever return to the sacred fields again. The outsiders always hoped and dreamed one day it would be different and they could reclaim their place in the fields. Sensing this unrest, the Ivory tried to divide and conquer by tricking the community, blackmailing or offering deals. The Ivory claimed to those they caught and singled out that if they forged the signatures of other outsiders, signed the names of their companions in the Book of the Known, they would be rewarded, perhaps even allowed to return to the fields. Out of desperation and dazzled by such wondrous temptations, some of the outsiders complied, too fearful to challenge what might happen if they didn't. Tensions were high, tempers were rife, particularly as the outsiders learned, people of the Ivory used their name as derogatory slang. Didn't like something? Oh, that's outside. Someone acted up? Oh, what are you, an outsider? Like the way they'd been treated wasn't despicable enough. Their very identity was synonymous with all that was terrible, unacceptable, strange. In turn, the Ivory didn't appreciate how outsiders seemed to speak in code, a language that dipped in and out of recognition, somewhere in between the native tongue and a perceived gibberish that made no sense to anyone but their own. Terms and phrases would come up while outsiders observed members of the Ivory. They burst into fits of laughter, which enraged the Ivory to no end. It seemed the communities could never see eye to eye, and distracted by all their own squabbles and fights, they didn't realise they were all in danger. One by one, people started to disappear again from the sacred fields, and they could never see what was taking them. Many suspected the return of the plague or even something worse. Now they had to rely on each other for safety, for only from the trees was there a clear vantage point to seek out who or what ever was plucking off bodies one by one. Something only the outsiders could provide. They'd been through so much, a plague, an exile. They knew far more about survival than the Ivory. And so the once prosperous Ivory fled from the fields to the forest and had to adjust to a new way of life, A learning to get along, understand one another, that different from us didn't mean wrong. It wasn't easy. Both sides had to work hard. But with each passing day, they learned more and more of one another's ways and began to appreciate, as much as they were different, they were the same. No matter where they came from, they were people of the same lands, just trying to find a way to live in peace. And each time there was a quarrel or a fight, those involved were reminded of how far they had come and how much better it was to be united. The motto by which they lived, those who forget history are doomed to relive it. Soon 100 years had gone by, and to celebrate this occasion, the Ivory wondered if the Outsiders might wish to choose a new name for themselves. But the Outsiders realised they liked their name. They'd reclaimed it, made it their own, and were proud of their history. No matter where they were, they would always remember what it had been like to be an outsider. They would use the lessons they'd learned to welcome anyone into their community, so no other living soul in need would ever experience the troubles that they had. No one need ever feel alone again. And once the two communities learned to coexist in the forest, the line between the sacred fields and the trees too began to blur and intertwine, until soon it was a lush, green utopia, protected and safe, open and spacious for all. Soon it was forgotten that there was ever a difference between them, much like the Ivory and the Outsiders. Very deep and meaningful, all these like hidden underlying subject matters, I know. And finally, I have an absolute treat written with the Derby Golden Rainbows. And again, this was a collaborative piece, much about their histories and life experiences that all came together to tell the story of the Forbidden Forest. So, far, far away from here, as these places tend to be, there once stood a very miserable place. It rained too much, and weeks could go by with no sun. The streets were grey, the houses were grey, the people who lived there, their clothes were grey. Dare I say, even their skin had a hue of sadness to it, from years of living on pale stews and light gruels, the only supplies available. And you'd hope a place as miserable as this, you'd have time to mope. But no, this was a city that was always too busy, forever full of hustle and bustle. Its people were trapped in routine, much like the city itself, which was enclosed by huge walls. Only one entrance led in and out, and it wasn't for public use. The kingdom was ruled by a queen named Camellia. Now, although Queen Camellia tried to do her best for her subjects, she wasn't the shiniest doubloon in the purse. Camellia was easily led astray all too often, especially by her royal advisor, Moretta, who had a reputation for being a cruel and unjust sorceress. Ooh. Oh, you're back in the room. Welcome back. Now, believe it or not, to the south of the grey city's walls stretched a vast, rich forest, miles and miles deep. To those like you and me, you'd wonder why the residents of this kingdom weren't jumping the walls into the trees. But Camellia's people were always told to dare not tread its lush green floors. Because her advisor, the devious sorceress, had whispered spells in the queen's ears that the forest was filled with wickedness. Its plants were poisoned, creatures unsafe. It was deathly and dangerous. Moretta insisted those who desired to visit the woods weren't to be trusted. And if anyone dared to enter, there was no coming back. They would have to be banished. Outcasts of society, doomed to wander through the trees, lost and alone, if they didn't perish. Because legend had it that at the forest's deepest, darkest centre dwelt a dragon named C'thol. And those who stumbled upon this monstrous lizard would be burned forever in damning flames.
No!
And so signs were displayed, notices handed out around the market and taverns. Beyond the walls is forbidden. Stay inside where it's safe. So fearful were the people of the grey city, a day came when they daren't even speak of the forest. But in that grey city lived a young man, Robin. Despite everything he'd been told, everything he'd ever known since he was a boy, Robin was drawn to the trees, and no matter how much he tried to dismiss or deny his feelings, something in Robin's gut told him. Surely, those woodlands couldn't be as evil as they'd been made out to be. If they were so terrible, why was the city built beside them? They seemed so inviting, so beautiful to him. And anything had to be better than all this grey. Yet he was afraid to speak any of this to those around him, not wanting to seem different to his family and friends, of questioning why the forest was forbidden. Robin felt alone in his thoughts. Though he wanted to tell someone, he was too scared. How would others react if they knew he was curious about what lay in the trees, beyond the grey city walls, beyond everything he and his people knew to be their way of life? Then, early one morning, before anyone else had risen, for the first time in weeks he saw the sun, breaking through what had been another grey and rainy night. Thrilled to see the light, Robin looked out the window, and from there he couldn't believe his eyes, the most beautiful thing he'd ever witnessed. What we know to be a rainbow, he'd never seen before. An arch high in the brightening sky, full of every colour, a stunning vision to him. And following its curve to the earth, that's when he noticed its tail ended in the middle of the forest. That's when he decided he would follow it, because something that beautiful could surely bring him no harm. He approached the border nearest his home, guarded by one of the huge walls of stone separating the houses from the woods. Determined to get to the end of the rainbow, Robin started to climb, clinging to the gaps of the rocks of the wall. He was terrified, but still, he found his strength. And before he knew it, he had reached the top of the wall. The rainbow still stretched out before him. Diving deep into green land, he now surveyed. He was trying to catch his breath from the climb, but the view tried to once more take it away. At least it was easier to get down the other side, as he had branches to hold onto, instead of just wall. When he reached the forest floor, he of course was a little apprehensive, still unsure if he was doing the right thing, but the more he walked through the wilderness, following the path laid out by the rainbow ahead, the less he doubted himself. The beauty of the flowers, the singing of birds, the scent of the air, fresher than anything he'd breathed in his entire life. He felt light, carefree. He could feel sun coming through the trees, which he realised were there as shelter, protection, life, not as something dark and looming. Robin skipped and pranced and laughed his way through the woods until finally he found the rainbow's end, and sitting under its light, glowing jewels. A pile of perfect little gems, reflecting every colour imaginable in the most beautiful way. As he picked one up, he could feel its power, like suddenly every worry and fear he'd ever had melted away. He felt at once harmony, joy, pride, like he was complete. Robin couldn't believe that this was what lay at the heart of the forest. No dragon, no flames, no damnation, but magic. The queen and the witch had lied. He had to tell the other people in the city that each of them had been under a deceitful spell, and so he returned home fast as he could to inform the others he'd been to the forest to show them what he'd discovered. He gathered as many gems as he could carry as proof, and once he got back to the city, began handing them out, excitedly announcing what he'd seen, how he'd felt, so others would now know the truth. One by one, they joined him, and they marched together with their tools, ready to tear down the grey city walls.
Yay!
Hearing there was a commotion in the town centre, the sorceress Moretta appeared, and she was furious. What's the meaning of all this? She demanded. When Robin and the people held up their gems to show her, you could have knocked her down with a feather. The gems were powerful enough to break her terrible spells and flooded her own greyness with colour. Overwhelmed, she fell to the ground, and the guards quickly seized her. With newfound strength and freedom, the people of the city held hands and began their multicoloured march towards the Queen's palace, lighting up more people on the way, spreading their joy. At the Queen's chambers, Robin bowed at the feet of the dopey queen, who, as it happened, was slumped half asleep in her chair, looking particularly fed up. On hearing she'd been just as misguided as the rest of them, Camellia wept, apologising again and again for her ignorance and mistakes. She ordered Moretta's arrest, who was stripped of her magics and ordered never to cast spells again. And so it became a tradition with each year that the people of the once grey city would don their most colourful clothes and march in a parade that started in the town square and ended at the palace, led by brave Robin at the front. Because even though Robin could have stayed in the forest and been free to start a new life, he realised that the rights of others to be free were just as important as his. Misguided, mistreated, afraid to live their lives free. Take heed of the sorceress's wicked ways. It takes just one person's cruelty to spread ignorance and hate, but only one person, like you, to lead the way to change. Thank you.